Chapter 24. My first port of call was the broker's tent, where I sold Zebra's weapon at what was probably an extortionate markdown on its true value. I could hardly complain. I was less interested in cash than in losing the weapon before it could be traced to me. The broker asked if it was hot, but I could see there was no real interest in his eyes. The rifle was far too cumbersome and conspicuous for an operation like the Rivage job. The only place you could walk into with a piece of hardware like that and not raise eyebrows would be a convention of heavy artillery fetishists. Madame Dominica, I was gratified to see, was still open for business. This time I didn't need to be dragged there, but walked in willingly, my coat pockets swinging with the ammo cells I had forgotten to sell.
"She no open for business," said Tom,
the kid who had originally hassled Quirinbach and myself. I palmed a few notes and slapped them on the table before Tom's goggle-eyed face. "She is now," I said, and pushed on through to the tent's inner chamber. It was dark, but it took only a second or two for the room's interior to snap into view, as if someone had turned on a very faint grey lantern. Dominica was sleeping on her operating couch, her generous anatomy shrouded in a garment which might have begun life as a parachute. "Wake up," I said not too loudly. "You've got a customer." Her eyes opened slowly like cracks in swelling pastry.
"What is this? You got no respect?"
The words came out quickly, but she sounded too lethargic to register real alarm.
"You ain't come barging in here?"
"My money seemed to cut some ice with your assistant." I dredged up another note and flashed it in front of her face. "How does this look to you?"
"I don't know. I can't see nothing. What's wrong with your eyes? Why they like that?"
"There's nothing wrong with my eyes," I said, and then wondered how convincing I sounded to her. After all, Laurent had said something similar, and it was a long time since I had experienced any difficulty seeing in the dark. I extinguished that line of thought, unsettling as it was, and kept up the pressure on Dominica. "I need you to do a job for me and to answer a few questions. That's not asking too much, is it?" She propelled her bulk from the couch, fitting her lower reaches into the steam-powered harness which waited by her side. I heard a hiss of leaking pressure as it took her bulk. Then Dominica moved away from the bed with all the grace of a barge.
"What kind job? What kind questions?"
"There's an implant I need removing. Then I need to ask some questions about a friend of mine."
"Maybe I ask you questions about friend too."
I had no idea what she meant by that. But before I could ask, she had turned on the tent's interior light, exposing her waiting instruments, clustered around the couch, which I now saw was spattered with faint rusty scabs of dried blood of varying vintage and hue.
"But that cost two. Show me implant."
I did, and after examining it for a few moments, her sharp, thimbled fingers digging into the side of my head, she seemed satisfied.
"Like game implant, but you still alive."
Evidently that meant it could not possibly be a game implant, and for a moment there was no faulting her logic. After all, how many of the hunted ever stood a chance of making it back to Madame Dominica and having the trace removed from their skulls? "Can you remove it?"
"If neural connection shallow, no problem."
Saying this, she guided me to the couch and swung a viewing device in front of her eyes, chewing her lower lip as she peered into my skull.
"No, neural connection shallow, barely reach cortex. Good news for you. But look like game implant. How it get there? Mendicants?"
Then she shook her head, the rolls of flesh around her neck oscillating like counterweights.
"No, not mendicants. Unless you lied to me yesterday, when you say you no have implants. And this insertion wound new, not even day old."
"Just get the damned thing out," I said, "or else I walk out of here with the money I've already given the kid."
"That you can do, but you no find better than Dominica. That not threat. That promise."
"Then do it," I said.
"First you ask question," she said,
levitating around the couch to prep her other instruments, swapping her thimbles with impressive dexterity. She carried a pouch of them somewhere down in the infolded complexity of her waist, finding those she wanted by touch alone, without cutting or pricking her fingers in the process. "I have a friend called Rivage," I said. "He arrived a day or two ahead of me, and we've lost touch. Revival amnesia, the mendicants said. They could tell me he was in the canopy, but no more than that."
"And?"
"I think there was a good chance he sought your services. or could not avoid them, I thought, he would have had implants that needed removing, like Mr. Quiddenbach, the other gentleman I travelled with. Then I described Ryvich to her, aiming for the kind of vaguely correct level of recall which would imply friendship rather than an assassin's physiometric target profile. It's very important that we get in contact, and so far I haven't succeeded.
What make you think I know this man?
I don't know. How much do you think it would take? Another 100? Would that jog your memory?
Dominica's memory, it not so fast this time of morning.
200, then. Now, is Mr. Ryvich springing to mind? I watched as a look of theatrical recollection appeared on her face. I had to hand it to her. She did it with style.
Oh, good. I'm so glad.
If only she knew exactly how much.
Mr. Ryvich, his special case.
Of course he was. An aristocrat like Ryvich, even on Sky's Edge, would have had almost as much ironmongery floating around in his body as a Belle Epoque high roller, maybe more than some top-level demarchists. And, like Quiddenbach, he would not even have heard of the melding plague until he arrived around Yellowstone. No time either to seek out the few remaining orbital clinics capable of doing the extraction work. He would have been in a hurry to get down to the surface and lose himself in Chasm City. Dominica would have been his first and last chance at salvation.
I know he was a special case, I said, and that's why I know you'd have a means to contact him.
Why I won't contact him?
I sighed, realizing that this was going to be hard work, or expensive, or both. Supposing you removed something from him, and he seemed healthy, and then a day later you discovered that there was something anomalous with the implant you'd removed, that perhaps it had plague traces. You'd be obliged to contact him then, wouldn't you? Her expression hadn't changed during all this, so I decided a little harmless flattery ought to be brought into play. It's what any self-respecting surgeon would do. I know not everyone around here would bother chasing up a client like that, but as you've just said, no one's better than Madame Dominica. She granted acknowledgement.
Client information confidential, Dominica added, but we both knew what that meant.
A few minutes later I was a few dozen notes lighter, but I also had an address in the canopy, something called Escher Heights. I had no idea how specific it was, whether it referred to a single apartment or a single building, or simply some predefined region of the tangle.
Now you close eyes, she said, pushing a blunt, thimbled fingertip against my forehead, and Dominica work her magic.
She administered a local anesthetic before getting to work. It didn't take her long, and I felt no real discomfort as she removed the Hunt implant. She might as well have been excising a cyst. I wondered why Waverley had not thought to include an anti-tamper system in the implant, but perhaps that had been considered just a tiny bit too unsporting. In any case, insofar as I understood things, based on what I had gleaned from Waverley and Zebra, in the normal rules of play the implant's telemetry was not meant to be accessed by the people actually doing the hunting. They were allowed to chase the prey using whatever forensic techniques they liked, but homing in on a buried neural transmitter was just too easy. The implant was purely for spectators, and for the people like Waverley who monitored the progress of the game. Idly, as my mind free associated on Dominica's couch, I thought of the refinements I might have introduced if it had been up to me. For a start, I would have made the implant very much harder to remove, putting in the deep neural connections Dominica had worried about, and then an anti-tamper system. Something which would fry the brain of the subject if anyone tried removing the implant ahead of time. I would also make sure that the hunters carried their own implants, equally difficult to remove. I'd arrange for the two types of implant, hunter and hunted, to emit some kind of coded signal which each recognized. And when the parties approached each other within some predefined radius, say a city block or less, I would arrange for both implants to inform their wearers of the proximity of the other, via the deep neural connections I had already sown. I would cut the voyeurs out of the loop completely, let them track the game in their own fashion, make the whole thing more private, and limit the number of hunters to a nice round number like one. That way, the whole thing would become infinitely more personal, and why limit the hunt to a mere 50 hours? In a city the size of this one, it struck me that the hunt could easily last 10 days, or longer, provided the target was allowed sufficient time to run and hide in the maze of the mulch.
For that matter, I saw no reason to limit the arena of play to the Mulch alone, or even to Chasm City. Why not every settlement on the planet, if they wanted a real challenge? Of course, there was no way they'd go for it. What they wanted was a quick kill, a night's blooding with as little expense, danger, and personal involvement as possible.
Okay, Dominica said, pressing a sterilized pad against the side of my head. You're done now, Mr. Mirabel.
She held the implant between two fingers, glinting like a tiny gray jewel.
And if this not hunt implant, then Dominica's skinniest woman in Chasm City.
You never know, I said. Miracles do happen.
Not to Dominica.
Then she helped me from the couch. I felt a little light-headed, but when I fingered the head wound, it felt tiny and there were no signs of infection or scarring.
You know, curious? She asked,
as I shrugged myself back into Vadim's coat, anxious for the anonymity it afforded despite the heat and humidity.
No curious, I mean, not curious.
About what?
I say I ask you questions about friend.
Rivage? We've already covered that. She began packing away her thimbles.
No, Mr. Quirrenbach, other friend, the one you with yesterday.
Actually, Mr. Quirrenbach and I were more acquaintances than friends. What was it anyway?
He pay me not to tell you this, good money, so I say nothing. But you rich man now, Mr. Mirabel, you make Mr. Quirrenbach seem poor. You get Dominica's drift?
You're saying Quirrenbach bribed you into secrecy, but if I top his bribe, I can bribe you out of it.
You smart cookie, Mr. Mirabel. Dominica's operations, they no give you brain damage.
Enthralled to hear it. With a long-suffering sigh, I reached into my pockets again and asked her to tell me what it was Quirrenbach had not wanted me to know. I was unsure exactly what it was I was expecting. Very little, perhaps, since my mind had not really had time to dwell on the idea that Quirrenbach had ever had something to hide.
He come in with you, Dominica said, dressed like you, mendicant clothes. Ask for implants out.
Tell me something I don't know. Dominica smiled then, a salacious smile, and I knew that whatever it was she was about to inflict on me, she was going to enjoy it.
He no have implants, Mr. Mirabel.
What do you mean? I saw him on your couch. You were operating on him. You'd shaved his hair.
He tell me make it look good. Dominica, she no ask questions. Just do what client says. Client always right. Especially when client pay good, like Mr. Quirrenbach. Client say fake surgery, shave hair, go through motion. But I never open his head. No need. I scan him anyway. Nothing in there. Him already clean.
Then why the hell would... And then suddenly it all made sense. Quirrenbach did not need to have his implants removed because, if he had ever had any to start with, they had been removed years earlier, during the plague. Quirrenbach was not from Grand Teton at all. He was not even from outside the system. He was local talent, and he had been recruited to follow me down and find out what was making me tick. He had been working for Rivage. Rivage had reached Chasm City ahead of me, traveling down while I was still having my memories reassembled by the Ice Mendicants. A few days' lead was not much, but it had obviously been sufficient time to recruit some help. Quirrenbach might have been his first point of contact, and then Quirrenbach had returned to orbit and mingled with the immigrants who had just arrived from beyond the system. His mission would have been simple enough. Investigate the people revived from the Orvieto and find someone who might just possibly be a hired killer. I thought back to how it had all happened. First, I had been accosted by Vadim in the commons of the Strelnikov. I had shrugged off Vadim, but a few minutes later I had seen him beating up Quirrenbach. I had crossed the commons sphere, forcing Vadim to give up on Quirrenbach, and then I had beaten up Vadim myself. I remembered well how it had been Quirrenbach who urged me not to kill him. At the time, I put it down to forgiveness on his part. Afterwards, Quirrenbach and I had then crawled to Vadim's quarters. I remembered again how Quirrenbach had at first seemed uneasy as we rifled through his belongings, Quirrenbach questioning the morality of what I was doing. I had argued with him, and then Quirrenbach had been forced to go along with the theft. All along, I hadn't seen the obvious, that Quirrenbach and Vadim were working together. Quinnenbach had needed a way to get close to me without rousing my suspicions, a way to find out more about me. The two of them had set me up, Vadim undoubtedly hurting Quinnenbach in the commons, but only because they needed that realism. They must have known I would be unable to resist intervening, especially after my earlier brush with Vadim. Later, when we had been attacked in the carousel, I remembered how I had seen Quinnenbach standing to one side, restrained by the other man, while I took the brunt of Vadim's punishment. I should have seen it then. Quinnenbach had latched onto me, which implied that he was very good at his job, that he had singled me out amongst all the passengers on the ship, but it was not necessarily like that. Ryvich might have employed half a dozen other agents to tail other passengers, all using different stratagems to get close to their targets. The difference was, the others were all shadowing the wrong person, and Quinnenbach, by luck or intuition or deduction, had hit the bullseye. But there was no way he could have known for sure. In all the conversations we had had, I had still been careful enough not to give away anything which would have established my identity as Kaweah's security man. I tried to put myself in Quirinbach's position. It must have been very tempting for him and Vadim to kill me, but they could not do that, not until they had become totally certain that I was the real assassin. If they had killed me then, they would never know for sure that they had got the man they were after, and that doubt would always shadow them. So Quinnenbach had probably been planning to tail me for as long as it took, as long as it took to establish a pattern, that I was after a man called Ryvich for some purpose unspecified. Visiting Dominica's was an essential part of his disguise. He must not have realized that, as a soldier, I would lack implants and would therefore not require the good madame's talents, but he had taken it calmly, trusting me with his belongings while he was under the knife. Nice touch, Quinnenbach, I thought. The goods had served to reinforce his story. Except again in hindsight, I should have realized. The broker had complained that Quinnenbach's experientials were bootlegged, that they were copies of originals he had handled weeks earlier. And yet Quinnenbach said he had only just arrived. If I checked the manifests of lighthuggers arriving in the last week, would I even find that a ship had come in from Grand Teton? Perhaps, or perhaps not. It depended on how fastidious Quinnenbach had been in the manufacturing of his cover. I doubted that it went very deep, since he would have had only a day or two to manufacture the whole thing from scratch. All things considered, he hadn't done an entirely bad job. It was sometime afternoon, when I had finished with Dominica, that the next houseman episode happened. I was standing with my back against the wall of Grand Central Station, idly watching a skilled puppeteer entertain a small group of children. The puppeteer worked above a miniature booth, operating a tiny model of Marco Ferris, making the delicately jointed, space-suited figurine descend a rock face formed from a heap of crumbled masonry. Ferris was supposed to be climbing into the chasm, because there was a pile of jewels at the base of the slope, guarded by a fierce nine-headed alien monster. The children clapped and screamed as the puppeteer made the monster lunge at Ferris. That was when my thoughts stalled, and the episode inserted itself, fully formed. Afterwards, when I'd had time to digest what had been revealed to me, I thought about the one that had come before it. The houseman episodes had begun innocently enough, reiterating Skye's life according to the facts as I knew them. But they'd begun to diverge, at first in small details and then with increasing obviousness. The references to the sixth ship didn't belong in any orthodox history that I'd ever heard of, and nor did the fact that Skye had kept alive the assassin who had murdered, or been given the means to murder, his father. But those were minor aspects of the story compared with the idea that Skye had actually murdered Captain Balcazar. Balcazar was just a footnote in our history. One of Skye's predecessors. But no one had ever intimated that Skye had actually killed him. Clenching my fist, blood raining against the floor of the concourse, I began to wonder what I'd really been infected with. There wasn't anything I could do about it. He was sleeping there, not making a sound. I never suspected anything was wrong. The two medics examining Balcazar had come aboard the instant the ship was secure, after Skye had raised the alarm about the old man. Valdivia and Rengo had closed the airlock behind them, so that they had space to work. Skye watched them intently. They both looked weary and sallow, with bags under their eyes from overwork. "He didn't cry out. gasp for air, anything like that? Said Rengo.
No, Skye said, not a peep. He made a show of looking distraught, but was careful not to overdo it. After all, with Balcazar out of the way, the path to the captaincy was suddenly much clearer than it had been before, as if a complicated maze had suddenly revealed itself to have a very simple route to its heart. He knew that. They knew it too, and it would have been even more suspicious if he had not tempered his grief with the merest hint of pleasure at his considerable good fortune.
"I'll bet those bastards on the Palestine poisoned him," Valdivia said. "I always was against him going over, you know."
"It was certainly a stressful meeting," Skye said.
"That was probably all it took," Rengo said, scratching at the raw pink skin under his eye. "There's no need to blame it on the others. He just couldn't take the stress."
"There's nothing I could have done, then." The other medic was examining the prosthetic web across Balcazar's chest, strapped on beneath the side-buttoned tunic which the men had now opened. Valdivia prodded the device doubtfully.
"This should have given off an alarm. You didn't hear one, I take it?"
"As I said, not a peep."
"Damn thing must have broken down again. Listen, Skye," Valdivia said, "if a word of this gets out, we're absolutely done for. That damn web was always breaking down, but the way Rengo and I have been overstretched recently—"
He blew out air and shook his head in disbelief at the hours he had been working.
"Well, I'm not saying we didn't repair it, but obviously we couldn't spend all our time nursing Balcazar to the exclusion of everyone else. I know they've got gear on the Brasilia better than this clapped-out rubbish, but what good does it do us?"
"Very little," Skye said, nodding keenly. "Other people would have died if you had devoted too much attention to the old man." "I understand perfectly."
"I hope you do, Skye, because there's going to be one hell of a shitstorm once news of his death leaks out."
Valdivia looked at the captain again, but if he was hoping for a miraculous recovery, there was no sign of it.
"We're going to come under examination for the quality of our medical support. You're going to be grilled about the way you handled the trip over to the Palestine. Ramirez and those other council bastards are going to try and say we screwed up. They're going to try and say you were negligent. Trust me, I've seen it all before."
"We all know it wasn't our fault," Skye said. He looked down at the captain, the stale trail of dried saliva still adorning his epaulette. "He was a good man. He served us well, long after he should have retired. But he was old."
"Yes. And he would have died in a year or so, no matter what happened. But try explaining that to the ship."
"We'll just have to watch our backs, then."
"Skye, you won't say a word, will you? About what we've told you?"
Someone was banging on the airlock, trying to get into the taxi. Skye ignored the commotion. "What do you want me to say, exactly?"
The medic drew in a breath. "You have to say the web gave you a warning. It doesn't matter that you didn't act on it. You couldn't have. You didn't have the resources or the expertise, and you were a long way from the ship."
Skye nodded, as if all this was perfectly reasonable and exactly what he would have suggested, just so long as I never imply that the prosthetic web never actually worked in the first place. The two medics glanced at each other.
"Yes," said the first. "That's exactly it. No one will blame you, Skye. They'll see that you did everything you could have done."
The captain, now that Skye thought about it, looked very peaceful now. His eyes were shut. One of the medics had fingered down his eyelids to give the man some semblance of dignity in death. It was, as Clown had said, entirely possible to imagine that the man was dreaming of his boyhood. Never mind that the man's childhood aboard the ship had been every bit as sterile and claustrophobic as Skye's own. The knocking on the airlock had not stopped.
"I'd better let that fellow in," Skye said. "Skye," the first medic said imploringly.
He put a hand on the man's forearm.
"Don't worry about it."
Skye composed himself and palmed the door control. Behind there were at least 20 people all wanting to be first into the cabin. They were all trying to get a look at the dead captain, professing concern while secretly hoping this was not another false alarm. Balcazar had been in the distasteful habit of almost dying for several years now.
"Dear God," said one of them, a woman from Propulsion Concepts. "It's true, isn't it? What in heaven's name happened?"
One of the medics started to speak, but Skye was faster.
"His prosthetic web malfunctioned," he said. "What?"
"You heard me. I was watching Balcazar the whole time. He was fine until his web started making an alarm sound. I opened his tunic and looked at the diagnostic readout. It said he was having a coronary."
"No,"
one of the medics said, but he might as well have been addressing an empty room.
And you're sure he wasn't having one? The woman said. Hardly. He was talking to me at the time, quite lucidly. No sign of discomfort, just annoyance. Then the web told me it was going to attempt defibrillation. Needless to say, he became quite agitated at that point.
And what happened then?
I started to try and remove the web, but with all the lines running into him, I realized it was going to be impossible in the seconds I had before the defib began. I had no choice but to get away from Balcazar. I might have been killed myself had I been touching him.
"He's lying," the medic said.
"Ignore him," Sky said placidly. "He's bound to say that, isn't he? I'm not saying this was deliberate." He allowed the word to linger, so that it would at least have time to settle in people's imaginations before he moved on. "I'm not saying this was deliberate. Just a terrible mistake due to overwork. Look at the two of them. These two men are close to nervous exhaustion. It's no wonder they started making mistakes. We shouldn't blame them too much for that." There. When the conversation was replayed in people's memories, what would stick out would not be Sky trying to weasel out of accepting the blame himself, but Sky being magnanimous in victory, even compassionate. They would see that and applaud, while at the same time conceding that some blame should still be apportioned to the sleepwalking medics. They would see no harm in that, Sky thought. A great and respected old man had died under regrettable circumstances. It was only right and proper that there should be some recrimination. He had covered himself well. An autopsy would establish that the captain had indeed died from heart failure, although neither the autopsy nor the memory readout from the prosthetic web would ever quite elucidate the precise chronology of his death.
"You did very well," Clown said.
True, but Clown deserved some credit as well. It was Clown who had told him to unbutton the tunic when Balcazar was asleep, and Clown who had shown him how to access the web's private functions so that he could program it to deliver the defibrillating pulse, even though the captain was as well as he had ever been lately. Clown had been clever, even if on some level Sky knew that this knowledge had always been his, but Clown had dredged it from his memory, and for that he was thankful. "I think we make a good team," Sky said under his breath. Sky watched the bodies of the men tumble into space. Valdivia and Rengo had died by the simplest means of execution available aboard a spacecraft, asphyxiation in an airlock, followed by ejection into the vacuum. The trial into the old man's death had taken up 2 years of ship time. Grindingly slow as appeals were lodged, discrepancies found in Sky's account, but the appeals had failed and Sky had managed to explain the discrepancies to almost everyone's satisfaction. Now a retinue of senior ship's officers crowded around the adjacent portholes, straining for a glimpse into the darkness. They had already heard the dying men thumping on the door of the airlock as the air was sucked from the chamber. Yes, it was a harsh punishment, he reflected, more so given the already overstretched medical expertise aboard the ship. But such crimes could not be taken lightly. It hardly mattered that these men had not meant to kill Balcazar with their negligence, although that lack of intention itself was open to doubt. No, aboard a ship, negligence was itself scarcely less a crime than mutiny. It would have been negligent, too, not to make examples of these men.
"You murdered them," Constanza said, quietly enough so that only he heard it. "You may have convinced the others, but not me. I know you too well for that, Sky."
"You don't know me at all," he said, his voice a hiss.
"Oh, but I do. I've known you since you were a child."
She smiled exaggeratedly, as if the two of them were sharing an amusing piece of small talk. "You were never normal, Sky. You were always more interested in twisted things like Sleek than real people, or monsters like the Infiltrator. You've kept him alive, haven't you?"
"Kept who alive?"
he said, his expression as strained as Constanza's.
"The Infiltrator."
She looked at him with narrow, suspicious eyes.
"If it even happened that way. Where is he anyway? There are 100 places you could hide something like that aboard the Santiago. One day I'll find out, you know. Put an end to whatever sadistic little experiment you're running, the same way I'll eventually prove that you framed Valdivia and Rengo. You'll get your punishment."
Sky smiled, thinking of the torture chamber where he kept Sleek and the Chimeric. The Dolphin was several degrees less sane than he had ever been, an engine of pure hate that existed only to inflict pain on the Chimeric. Sky had conditioned Sleek to blame the Chimeric for his confinement, and now the dolphin had assumed the role of devil against the god that Skye had become in the Chimeric's eyes. It had been much easier to shape the Chimeric that way, giving him a figure to fear and despise, as well as one to revere. Slowly but surely, the Chimeric was approaching the ideal Skye had always had in mind. By the time the Chimeric was needed, and that would not be for years to come, the work would be done. "I don't know what you mean," he said. A hand rested on his shoulder. It was Ramirez, the leader of the Executive Council, the shipwide body with the power to elect someone to the vacant captaincy. Ramirez, they were saying, was very likely to be Balcazar's successor. "Monopolizing him again, Constanza?" the man said.
"We were just going over old times," she answered.
"Nothing that can't wait, I assure you." "He did us proud, don't you think, Constanza? Other men might have been tempted to give those fellows the benefit of the doubt, but not our Skye."
"Not him, no,"
Constanza said, before turning away. "There's no room for doubt in the flotilla," Skye said, watching the two bodies dwindle. He nodded to the captain, lying in state in his own cooled casket. "If there's one lesson that dear old man taught me, it's never to give any house room to uncertainty." "That dear old man," Ramirez sounded amused. "Balcazar, you mean? He was like a father to me. We'll never see his like again. If he were alive, these men would be lucky to get away with anything as painless as asphyxiation. Balcazar would have seen a painful death as the only valid form of deterrence." Skye looked at him intently. "You do agree, don't you, sir?"
"I wouldn't pretend to know."
Ramirez seemed slightly taken aback, but he blinked and continued speaking. "I had no great insights into Balcazar's mind, Houseman. Word is, he wasn't at his very sharpest towards the end, but I suppose you'd know all about that, having been his favorite." Again that hand on the shoulder. "And that means something to some of us. We trusted Balcazar's judgment, just as he trusted Titus, your father. I'll be frank. Your name has been bandied about. What would you think to... the captaincy? No sense in beating about the bush. It's a bit premature, isn't it? Besides, someone with your own excellent record and depth of experience? A year ago I might have agreed. I will probably take over, yes. But I'm not a young man, and I doubt that it'll be very long before questions are being asked about my likely successor.
You have years ahead of you, sir."
"Oh, I may live to see journey's end, but I'll be in no position to oversee the difficult early years of the settlement. Even you will no longer be a young man when that happens, Houseman. But you will be much younger than some of us. Importantly, I see you have nerve, as well as vision." Ramirez glanced at Skye oddly. "Something's troubling you, isn't it?" Skye was watching the dots of the executed men dissolve into darkness, like two tiny spots of cream dropped into the blackest coffee imaginable. The ship was not under thrust, of course. It had been drifting for Skye's entire life, which meant that the men were taking an eternity to fall away.
"Nothing, sir. I was just thinking. Now that those two men have been ejected, and we don't have to carry them with us anymore, we'll be able to decelerate just that little bit harder when it comes time to initiate the slowdown burn. That means we can stay in cruise mode a little longer at our current speed. It means we'll reach our destination sooner, which means those men have, in some small, barely sufficient way, paid us back for their crimes."
"You do come out with the oddest things, Houseman." Ramirez tapped him on the nose and leaned closer. There had never been any danger of the other officers overhearing the conversation, but now he was whispering. "Word of advice. I wasn't joking when I said your name had been bandied about, but you aren't the only candidate, and one wrong word from you could have a disastrous effect on your chances. Am I making myself clear?"
"Crystal, sir."
"Good. Then watch your step. Keep your head about you at all times. And you may be in with a chance." Skye nodded. He imagined that Ramirez expected him to feel grateful for this titbit of confidentiality, but what Skye actually felt, and did his level best to hide, was unmitigated contempt. As if the wishes of Ramirez and his cronies in any way influenced him, as if they actually had any say in whether he became captain or not, the poor blind fools.
"He's nothing," Skye breathed, "but I've got to let him feel he is useful to us."
"Of course," Clown said, for Clown had never been far away. "It's what I would do."